didn't like making mistakes, though he didn't mind hiding behind an apology and the claim of a mistake that wasn't really a mistake. Buonarroti's vampires probably wouldn't attack Harris and his man by accident. But if it was in the Lord of Night's best interests to have them trapped here without a pilot... Adam sighed audibly and said, "Oh, put them somewhere near us. At least that way, if someone starts screaming, there's a good chance we will hear them." The vampire drew himself up. "Do you doubt my master's honor?" "No," Adam said, "but I won't trust the self-control of vampires I don't know when presented with prey that looks like this." He waved a hand at Harris, who raised a good-looking eyebrow. "Sorry," he apologized. "This is really what I look like. I don't have enough magic to keep up glamour." "When things might get dangerous and I might need every ounce of power I've got," the goblin pilot didn't say. Probably the vampires wouldn't hear the unspoken message, and if they did, likely they'd understand the reasoning behind it. Harris frowned suddenly at Adam. "And you have no room to talk."
"Yes," Elisaveta said venomously. "We are all beautiful here. Can we get going? Or do I need to get the makeup mirror out of my purse so you two can admire yourselves a little longer?"
She looked at the vampire.
"I hope there are sufficient bathrooms in the suite. I don't like to share," she glanced at Adam, laughter in her eyes, "bathrooms."
Buonarroti's minion nodded, but he wasn't really paying attention to Elisaveta, which was a mistake he might regret. It didn't do to forget that she was a power who could make even the Grey Lords of the Fae back down. Instead of paying attention to someone who could make him wish she was only killing him, he was staring at Harris's co-pilot, who had been doing a pretty good job of being unnoticeable. "That one is a werewolf," he said abruptly, as if he'd just figured it out. Harris frowned irritably.
"I was told that this involved vampires. I have 5 people who can fly this bird from the U.S. to Europe, excluding me. 4 of them are humans, so I brought the werewolf. He doesn't belong to Hauptmann's pack. I cleared it with Hauptmann."
He turned his frown to Adam.
"I was told a pilot and co-pilot were acceptable," said Adam coolly. "What race or species they belonged to was not specified."
The vampire was doing its mind-out-of-body thing again. When he came back, the vampire's body language changed entirely, and the beast who lived in Adam's heart suddenly took notice. Adam didn't know who was looking out of the head minion's eyes, though he had a good guess. One thing Adam knew was that it certainly wasn't the vampire he'd just been talking to.
"Are you Charles Corning?"
the vampire asked the man standing just behind Harris. The werewolf's jaw dropped.
"Oh, hell no, sir,"
he said in a shaky voice, his shoulder bumping into Harris's. He might as well have screamed, "I'm a victim to the biggest predator in Europe." Adam could see the urge to attack slide into the bodies of all the vampires in the area, including Marsilia and Stefan. Adam pinched his nose and closed his eyes briefly as the weight of responsibility fell on his shoulders. He had to keep all of these people safe, and they were going to be doing their best to get themselves killed. Some of them because he had asked it of them. The only shining thread in this whole mess was that Mercy had managed to extract herself. Buonarroti did not have Mercy. Harris's co-pilot continued to babble, the smell of his panic filling the air.
"Have you ever seen Charles? He's about 20 feet tall, and he's Native American. Do I look Native American to you?"
"Leave him alone, Buonarroti," said Adam. "He's not your food. He is..." Adam surveyed the trembling wolf without affection, but sighed. "He is under my protection."
"I thought you said he wasn't one of yours," the vampire observed.
"He doesn't belong to my pack," Adam said, "but for the purposes of this trip, he put his neck on the line for me. That means he is mine to protect."
Buonarroti's puppet turned to Adam.
"My apologies," Buonarroti said through his puppet's mouth. "But you pricked my temper, because I am most disappointed. I was sure you'd bring the boogeyman of the werewolves. I've been looking forward to meeting him."
"I did ask," said Adam coolly, "but the Maroc forbade it."
Charles is very good at ending people. Monsters, let's say. And the Maroc apparently thinks that bringing him here, where there are so many monsters to be slain, would be a bad idea. Maybe he believes that. Maybe he believes this is my problem, not his. And he doesn't want to risk losing Charles. Or maybe he is reluctant to deal with the headache of the power vacuum that your death at Charles's hands would leave in Europe. It would be nearly as large a mess as the death of Jean Chastel, the beast of Gévaudan left.
Charles didn't kill the beast, said Bonarata.
The vampire's voice wasn't as certain as it would have been if he knew what he said was a fact.
Adam shrugged.
I wasn't there when Chastel died.
Charles had been, though, and rumor persisted in laying the old villain's death at Charles's feet, as if Charles's reputation needed any help from killings he hadn't performed. Whether it had been at Charles's hand or not wasn't the point. Adam was just reminding Bonarata that even powerful old monsters could die.
Master, said a soft voice.
It belonged to the vampire who had been on the crew that had taken Mercy.
You asked me to remind you when you were close to harming one of your own?
Bonarata, still possessing his minion, nodded.
Grazie, Ignazio.
Hauptmann, I look forward to meeting you and yours in person. My people will escort you to my home.
Then the vampire staggered, dropped to his knees, and shivered in a fit, very like a grand mal seizure. Ignazio and Adam stored his name for future reference, waved, and a couple of the vampires picked up their fallen companion. Ignazio bowed.
If you would be so kind as to follow me?
As they walked to the waiting vehicles just off the runway, Adam walked behind Ignazio and to his right. Your scent was on my wife's car seat along with her blood, he murmured, though everyone in their group would hear him. Quiet, he had found, could be a lot more menacing than loud. The wolf wanted to kill him, but Adam understood about being a soldier and taking orders. Still, Adam said, I will remember.
Pack remembers, Honey added.
6. Mercy. So from now on, the timing between my part of the story and Adam's gets tricky, and you'll have to pay attention. This chapter begins late afternoon, the day after Adam and his people land in Milan. I'm asleep, with my face plastered against the top of a metal table. Being sophisticated like this just comes naturally to me. What can I say? I woke up. My cheek was half glued to the tabletop from drying sweat and probably drool. But I didn't pry it loose, because there was a werewolf watching me, and I was still caught up in dreams that had me riding a troll over the cable bridge, jousting with the Golem of Prague, while the drowned ghosts of 1,000 werewolves climbed up the side of the bridge asking for jelly beans. I needed a moment before I could deal with the real live werewolf. The troll I got, and the golem, of course, but I couldn't figure out why the wolves wanted jelly beans.
I know you are awake, Mercedes Hauptmann, growled a soft tenor voice, with the seductively thick vowels that the Slavic languages are famous for.
Czech was different from the Russian accents that I was more familiar with. Throatier and deeper. Not so much less musical as bassier musical. I sighed, sat up, and rolled my head, then my shoulders to ease my muscles. Now I'll never find out why it was jelly beans, I said.
Jelly beans? He asked.
I drew a deep breath. Just a dream, I told him, and took a good look at Libor of Prague, the alpha who had some sort of secret grudge against the Maroc. He smelled of werewolf, of butter and yeast and wheat and eggs, and a little of the same fruit filling I'd eaten in the pastries he'd fed me earlier. The smell was sweet and rich, like jelly beans. Libor looked nothing like I imagined him, at least not as I'd imagined him when I was a child. Probably that was a good thing for him. His hair was medium brown and cut almost brutally short. His face was clean-shaven, but, like Adam tended to, he already had a shadow of a beard making itself felt this late in the afternoon. Libor, the Alpha of Prague, was a big man, not so much tall as massive. There was something more leonine than lupine about him. His features were of average attractiveness. He was neither beautiful nor ugly. It was a strong face, and intelligent. He reminded me superficially of Buonarroti, in that people would look at him and expect brutality and risk missing the intelligence altogether. But Buonarroti had been cold all the way to the bone. Any warmth I'd seen in him was an illusion created by a master manipulator. Libor, my coyote informed me, was many things, but cold was not one of them. He smiled as I met his eyes and held them. His smile expected me to turn my gaze away and leave him in charge. His problem was that I had just had a few very bad days and was done with being vulnerable and lost. A minute passed. Two.
"You tread upon dangerous ground, little wolf," he said softly.
"My apologies," I said insincerely without dropping my eyes. One of the cool things about my coyote is that dominance battles aren't usually a problem for me. I could stare down just about anyone except for the Maroc himself. Libor wasn't my alpha, and I was just not going to give in. After a moment, my brain kicked in. Staring down a werewolf was dumb. I'd spent my life trying not to be any dumber than I had to be. After a few more heartbeats, during which time I acknowledged to myself that I was antagonizing someone I hoped to elicit help from and being dumb with no end in sight, I said, "I'm trying for strong enough to pay attention to, but polite enough not to cause a real fight. How am I doing?" He lost his smile, which was good, because it had become sharp around the edges, and he narrowed his eyes until I could feel his power beating at me angrily. "As I said," he told me, his voice as casual as his eyes were not, "dangerous. You should probably consider how thrilled, yes, that is the word, how thrilled I am to have the daughter of Brand's heart here in my territory. It is something that gives me great pleasure." He didn't look like a man who was pleased. He looked like a starving wolf who'd caught a glimpse of a wounded deer. Pleased was such a bland word for that emotion. I tried to figure out how to answer him. Death threats, and he had just issued one, if obliquely, are to be gotten through as lightly as possible. I'd noticed that if I paid too much attention to them, matters tended to proceed from bad to worse. I was tired, and I'd hesitated too long to deny that Bran had treated me like a daughter before he'd abandoned me in the pack for political reasons. Our pack was the only pack in North America not affiliated with the Maroc. We stuck out like a big sore thumb. And someday soon, someone was going to give in to curiosity and see what happened when they hit us, as they would not dare do to one of the packs under the Maroc. I took a breath. Had I misread Buonarroti? Had that been what he was doing? Did his kidnapping of me have nothing to do with Marsilia at all? But Buonarroti was in Italy, and I was sitting across the table from a werewolf I needed to pay attention to instead of playing my I-wonder-why-the-big-bad-vampire-took-me game. I had missed my chance to claim that Bran didn't care about me. Likely, Libor wouldn't have believed my disclaimer anyway, because I only mostly believed it. Bran hadn't abandoned us because he didn't love me anymore. He'd abandoned us because he had a greater cause, the survival of the werewolves, that he loved more. So, death threat. It was likely that Libor didn't intend to kill me unless I pushed him into it. First, Charles had sent me here. Though Charles maintained that he wasn't good with people, which was true enough, it didn't keep him from reading people pretty well. Second, and even more telling, I wasn't already dead. Alpha werewolves don't tend to be the kind of people who dither. I realized I was watching my fingers tap on the table. At some time during my thinking process, I dropped my eyes to the table. It hadn't been because I'd been intimidated, or at least I didn't think so. But if I was going to get into a staring contest with a dominant wolf, I probably should have been paying more attention. "I had heard that you and Bran weren't on speaking terms," I said. "So, you'd have killed me already, but you don't want me to die before I satisfy your curiosity?" I hazarded lightly. Not afraid of the big bad wolf. No, sir, not me. You want to know what I'm doing alone in your territory and why I mentioned the Lord of Night? I shrugged. Otherwise, I'd probably be dead instead of fed good food and left to sleep in safety. He leaned back comfortably in his chair, it creaked alarmingly, and said nothing. I am here because of Buonarrota, I said blandly. He kidnapped me about a mile from my home in the U.S. Apparently he was under the impression that I was the most powerful supernatural entity in the territory of his discarded mistress and one true love. I think he'd forgotten all about her until recent events put the Tri-Cities of Washington, state of, USA, into national and international news. Reminded of his love, he chose to go after her by kidnapping me. That was my current favorite theory. Or maybe it was a hit directed at Bran, or the Pack. But I'd go with my first instinct. So I nodded, as if he'd said something, and continued. I know. It struck me as stupid, too. But I'm not an ageless vampire, so I'll cut him some slack.
Are you? Libor asked.
Am I what?
The most powerful supernatural entity in the Tri-Hotzit City.
I change into a coyote, I countered. That's my superpower. What do you think? He'd been sarcastic with his question. But at my answer, he straightened ever so slightly and looked intrigued.
I had forgotten that about you, he said slowly, and I do not think that you have answered my question, which I find very interesting. Are you the most powerful supernatural creature in your territory?
I shrugged uncomfortably because I couldn't lie to him. Maybe, I said, possibly, but not because of what I am, more because of who I know. I was raised in the Morax Pack. I made it to Adam Hauptmann, who is alpha of our pack and not least among alphas in the other packs. I have a friend who is Fae, and he is someone even the Grey Lords don't mess with. They were looking for more pieces of one of the Grey Lords who had ticked Z off. My informant, Tad, was pretty sure that they would find them all. Eventually. I have a friend in the human police department and another in the local vampire seed. I shrugged again. Anyway. Buonarrota was disappointed because he'd expected someone, I tried to decide how to explain it.
More powerful, Libor supplied.
I shook my head. Whose power wasn't all in the people she knows, intrinsic power. I waved a hand vaguely down myself. Stronger, at least. Anyway, he decided to engineer my failed escape, during which I would conveniently die, and he could blame it on me and humiliate my mate for failing to take care of me. Instead, I really did escape, hopped on a bus, and ended up here, penniless, friendless, and passportless.
Pathetic, in fact, he said dryly.
I widened my eyes and nodded, answering the humor in his eyes with my own sincerity. On the way here, I got pickpocketed. They stole half of my money. I have about 200 corona left. That I had stolen first. Borrowed, really, since I intended to pay it back with interest. But borrowed without consent was, strictly speaking, theft. I'm about as pathetic as it gets, I told him honestly. He folded his arms.
Peanut butter, he said.
Excuse me? I tried to sound blank. That stupid story had made it all the way here? Jeepers, creepers, if I'd known how long I'd have to live with that, I'd have figured out some other way to get back at Bran.
You, he said, are Bran's little coyote girl who made him sit in peanut butter because he made your mama cry.
Foster mother, actually, but I wasn't about to correct him. Not until I knew him better, or it was over something more important. He gave me a wolfish smile.
You wrapped his new and very expensive car around the tree. People still talk about the chocolate Easter bunny incident with awe. And still, Bran did not kill you. You escaped from the Lord of Night, Master of Milan. And you want me to think you pathetic?
He leaned forward.
I know a little more about you, Miss Hauptmann, than that old vampire did. I do not think you would find it so easy to get away from me.
But you haven't taken me prisoner. I reminded him and carefully didn't say yet. So I don't have any reason to run away. Charles told me that I should throw myself on your mercy and ask you to help me stay alive and out of Buonarrota's clutches until Adam can get to me here.
Charles said that, he said neutrally.
Well, I tried to stick to the absolute truth. It was through a third party, and our communication was necessarily brief, but I can read between the lines. I would rather you come with me to storm the seed of the Master of Milan so that we could extract my husband and the small number of people he took with him to broker my release, which brokering is now unnecessary.
No, he said.
I gave him a look. Do I look stupid to you? Tired, pathetic, yes, stupid, not usually. I'm not going to ask you to face down any vampire in his den for me, let alone the Lord of Night. I request, respectfully, sanctuary for 3 days. Charles seemed to think it would allow you to count coup on Bran if you protected me when he couldn't.
You are the mate of another alpha, he said, his eyes half-lidded with menace. Intruding on my territory without prior arrangements, I could have you killed for that alone.
I kind of thought we were past the death threats, but apparently I was wrong. Yes, I agreed, but it wasn't on purpose, and killing me would make you look like a real jerk. He laughed.
You think I mind looking like a real jerk?
He tasted those two words as if they were something he hadn't said before.
Do you?
But his whole body had relaxed. Once they laugh, they are mine, mostly. If you were going to kill me, I said, you'd have done it already.
You, he said evenly, you are a threat to my people. If I grant you sanctuary and you die, the Maroc will come here and kill my people while I watch. If Buonarrota comes after you, he will do his best to kill my people, and he will never let it drop.
Libor, said a small voice chidingly, you are being mean to the nice lady. Stop it.
I looked. I couldn't help it. I hadn't heard anyone come in, hadn't smelled anyone approach, and as wound up as I felt, I should have. I'd expected a child, but instead there was a woman with bright blue eyes and curly hair several shades lighter than Libor's, a medium brown. She was wearing a folk costume, a more authentic version of what the man at the counter had been wearing, a simple white blouse with a string neck covered partially by a laced-up, heavily embroidered bodice. She wore a multitude of lightweight, bright-colored skirts of various lengths. Her face was cheerful and rounded, like her body. She met my gaze and grinned.
My Libor, he has grown cranky. He needs a good meal and his wife to cheer him up.
Don't look at me, I told her. I'm not that young, and I'm very much married. About that time I realized several things. The first was that her English was awfully good, complete with an American accent that came straight out of the Pacific Northwest. The second was that she was about 4 feet from me, and I still didn't smell her. The third was that Libor, after a quick glance behind him that didn't land on the woman whose hand was on his shoulder, stared at me intently, his eyes going gold with the presence of his wolf. "Damn it," I said with feeling. I was good at this. I was very good at spotting the ghosts. The days of my randomly addressing people and only realizing later that no one else could see them were long gone, or so I thought. The golem's odd effect on my ability with ghosts was still making my life difficult.
I had heard this, Libor said, frowning, that the Maroc's little coyote could see ghosts.
The ghost behind him smiled at me and brushed at Libor's hair as if there were something out of place, though his hair wasn't long enough to be obstreperous. She leaned back and angled her face as if checking to make sure she'd managed everything correctly, and I suddenly knew without a doubt what it was that Libor held against the Maroc. Zack. If this woman were male and had been starved for 6 months, then she'd be a dead ringer for our pack's sole submissive wolf, Zack. It wasn't just a passing resemblance. I'd seen twins who didn't share as many similarities. Zack had come to us a restless wanderer who showed signs of abuse. He gradually settled into the pack, losing most of the wariness he'd arrived with. But Zack still thought he was going to take off again for someplace else someday real soon. But that real soon had changed in emphasis, as if it were gradually lengthening from probably tomorrow to next week, and finally a vague time receding into the future. He was rooming with Warren and his human partner Kyle, another temporary situation that was sliding into a permanent one. Warren's presence kept the pack happy with the safety of our submissive wolf, something that preoccupied the wolves in a way I'd never understood until Adam had made me part of the pack's magical ties. And Warren was never obvious with his protectiveness. Unlike almost any other old wolf I've ever met, and Zack had once told me he'd been a werewolf for over a century, Zack was not homophobic and seemed content with the place he'd made for himself in Warren and Kyle's home. The whole pack was trying to make a home for Zack with us, and we were all holding our breath, hoping he wouldn't notice until it was too late and he already belonged to us. A submissive wolf was a gift to any pack. They tended to cut down the petty bickering that was part and parcel of having a room full of dominant personalities, and they settled the pack, made it feel for everyone as if pack was more than a necessity, that it was a good thing to be a part of. A submissive made the survival of all the wolves in the pack more likely. I don't know how Zack had become a bone of contention between Lubor and Bran, but I would bet all the money I didn't have at the moment that he was at the bottom of their feud. Because there was no way that lady could look so much like Zack and not be closely related to him.
"There's a ghost here," said Lubor.
I looked at him and sighed. "I try not to pay attention to them," I told him. "There's no good to be had from it."
"Who is it?" he asked.
"Don't tell him," said the ghost, still sounding like she'd grown up in Aspen Creek, Montana, like I had. Some of the stronger spirits did that. They communicated so forcefully that I heard them without any distortion, as if death granted them a universal language, a quick conduit to my brain without language at all, maybe. I found it very disturbing when they did that. It would hurt him to know that I watch over him still. But she didn't. Not really. This wasn't truly the woman she resembled, just a skin of personality shed when she died however long ago, and her soul had gone to wherever souls go. I didn't know why some ghosts stayed fresh and strong, while most others faded, though sometimes it was because the living paid too much attention to the dead. But that didn't make the ghosts into the person whose face they wore. It just made them stronger ghosts. I'd seen souls tied to their ghosts once, and I'd never again made the mistake of thinking of a normal ghost as a real person. This woman's soul had gone on a long, long time ago. I was coming to believe that ghosts were something, though, something that could think and plan and do. Not living, precisely, but not inert either. It was a belief that went against everything I've ever heard about ghosts, but I interact with them more than most people. Still, even though she was not the person who had been Libor's wife, she had once been part of her. She knew Lubor, and I chose to follow her advice. "I don't know, and I'm not going to talk about it long enough to give it more power," I told Lubor. "Look, ghosts are like discarded clothing left behind when a person dies." Of so much, I was still sure. "I'm sorry to distract you from the matter at hand. I wouldn't have if I weren't tired."
"Is it my wife?" he asked softly.
"She was a tiny thing, but rounded where a woman should be rounded. Her eyes were blue as a Viking's."
"I don't talk about ghosts I see," I told him. "No good comes of it." The ghost of his wife smiled at me. "He doesn't like it when people don't do what he says. I'd watch my step if I were you." Another ghost had found its way out to the courtyard, attracted by the attention I was trying not to pay to Libor's dead wife. This one wasn't anything anyone would have called pretty. Werewolf killed, I'd guess from the damage. If I were a normal human, I'd probably have been more appalled. But my other self is a coyote. I might not take down humans or any other large prey, but I've eaten a lot of field mice and rabbits. I let my gaze pass over that ghost.
"Is it my wife?"
Lubor asked intently, and this time there was a bit of growl in his voice. "I don't talk about ghosts," I told him. "I don't describe them. I don't name them. I don't look at them if I can help it." We had ourselves a little bit of a stare down again. Three more ghosts, one of those I'd seen in the main room of the bakery, drifted in.
I was busy staring at Libor, and it weirded me out that I still knew they'd come in. Usually I have to use my eyes, or ears, or nose, or some normal thing to know when they are around. Evidently not today. Stupid golem. Look, I said. It isn't safe to pay too much attention to ghosts. They start to linger, and they pull you in the wrong direction. My half-brother had told me that it was less safe for someone of our lineage to pay attention to the dead than it was for regular people. Too much attention tended to strengthen ghosts and anchor them in the world of the living. Attention from one of our kind was apparently even more energizing.
I am very old, little girl, Libor told me. If ghosts were going to get me killed, they would have done it a long time ago.
He frowned at me with consideration.
You will tell me what I want to know, and I will give you your 3 days.
You want me to describe the ghost I see here, I asked him, though I have clearly stated that it is a bad idea. But after I do this, you will grant me sanctuary for 3 days.
Yes, he said, sounding half irritated, half amused. Talk for 2 minutes, a description, and maybe a little conversation. Then I and my pack will protect you for 3 days. I give you the better end of the bargain.
He was going to get the bad end of the bargain, that was for certain. Fine. I'd warned him, and it was on his head. He was so certain he wanted me to do this, I was going to do it right for him. I closed my eyes and tried to draw upon the power that I'd only touched a time or two on purpose. There were a lot of ghosts here in the courtyard of Libor's bakery, more than I'd sensed before. When I reached out to them, it felt as though I were breathing them, bits of pain and fear and terror, most so faint that they'd lost any touch of personality or coherence. I opened my eyes and looked around. I might have been a little ticked with Libor for not listening to me when I told him it was a bad idea, but I was also concerned about adding any power to the woman who was still petting him. If she could get into my head enough to talk to me without an accent, then she was powerful enough to affect things in the real world, and if I gave her more power while he was still here loving her, I might never be able to get rid of her. She was tied to Libor already. People tied too closely to ghosts tended to do things like drive their cars into trees, shoot themselves, or drink themselves to death. The dead want to be closer to the living. So I picked someone else. He looks as though he was attacked by your pack, I told Libor with not really faked reluctance. This guy wasn't someone I'd want to be haunted by. The suit he is wearing looks like it is from the 1950s, and it looks like he was wearing it when he was killed because it is shredded and covered with blood.
Dan,
whispered the ghost painfully, though the bottom half of his face was gone.
Dan.
Under my attention, the misty edges of the transparent body drew together, condensing and solidifying at the same time. His name is Dan.
Danek.
The ghost's voice was suddenly stronger, as if my voice on his name was giving him energy. Danek, I said at the same time Libor did. As soon as I spoke his name, the ghost was as solid as any person I've ever seen in my life. I could smell him. Could smell his anguish and his sweat. I could see the weave of his blood-soaked silk tie. If I'd seen him on the street, I'd have called 911 for him. What had that golem done to me? And how?
Danek is a ghost? Asked Libor, who evidently wasn't getting the same sensory load as I was,
because though he looked over his shoulder, he wasn't looking in the right direction. Apparently, I told him. The old wolf laughed without amusement.
Of course he is. Danek never knew which way to go without someone's telling him first when he was alive. It makes sense that he'd be the same dead.
I almost gave my speech about how ghosts are not really the people who died again, but Libor was one of those people who liked to tell others how the world worked and not listen to anyone who thought differently. I kept my mouth closed. Libor smiled sourly.
Danek worked for the resistance here, such as it was during World War II. His resistance group contained some of my pack and was supported by the rest of us. We only found out later, after the war was over, that he'd been working for both sides. He told the Nazis that the people who planned the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich came from the village of Lidice. It wasn't true. The Nazis even knew it wasn't true, but they paid him. Do you know what they did to Lidice?
I did, actually. I'd written a term paper on the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich in Prague in May of 1942. Heydrich had survived the initial attempt, and if he hadn't been adamant that only German surgeons work on him, he might have lived through it. Then again, maybe he'd been right to be afraid. If I'd been a Czech surgeon, I'd have made sure Heydrich didn't survive. Heydrich made Hitler look like he should win the Humanitarian of the 20th Century Award. Nasty piece of work. In any case, Heydrich died, and so had Lidice.
The Nazis killed all the men over 15 right off the bat,
Libor told me without waiting for my reply.
They picked out a handful of very young children who looked German and sent those off to be raised as good little Nazis. Then they shipped the women and the rest of the children to concentration camps. They killed all the livestock and all the pets in the village. They looted the village down to digging up the cemetery, hunting for gold teeth or jewelry. When they were done, they burned the buildings. When that wasn't complete enough for them, they blew it up. They covered the whole thing with topsoil and planted it. The roads that led in and out of town were rerouted, as was a stream. When they finished, there was no sign that Lidice had ever existed there.
Delenda est Carthago, said the ghost, just before Libor said the same thing.
When the Romans destroyed Carthage, they leveled it so not one stone stood upon another, Libor continued. Lidice was a multi-level message from the Nazis. The first message was to those under their rule that any assassination would be punished, and punishment would not just fall on the conspirators, but on their families. Second, to the German people, that Heydrich was properly avenged, and that it was Czech rebels, not Hitler, who engineered his death. Heydrich was being groomed, or grooming himself, accounts vary, to take over the Third Reich from Hitler. Heydrich, unlike Hitler, was tall, blonde, athletic, and smart. The German ideal, in fact, which Hitler himself was not.
Had we killed Heydrich? They asked me, said Danik's ghost. How could I tell the Nazis that? They would have killed me, too, even though I was working for them. They would have asked why I had not warned them. If I told them nothing, they would have suspected me. So I gave them something else. A rumor, I said, that the assassins came from a little village. They didn't need the real assassins if they had a village to punish. Lidice didn't die for a lie. For my lie. Not really. It died so we could go on fighting the Nazis. We won. We beat them. I did the right thing. For Prague. For the resistance.
The other ghosts, including the woman who must, from his description and her behavior, have been Libor's wife, were backing away from Danik, as if something about him was repellent to other ghosts. They drifted almost casually through the walls, until by the end of Danik's self-justification speech, the only ghost in the garden was Danik's. I was working really hard at keeping a calm facade. I'd never done anything like this. I was pretty sure that I should have kept on following my brother's advice instead of giving in to my temper when Libor pushed me.
We killed Danik when we found out what he had done, Libor said. He knew what the Nazis would do, and he gave them a random target that was away from him. A village small enough to destroy, because that's what Hitler wanted.
Monsters, said Danik in my ear.
I might have jumped a little, because he hadn't been anywhere close to me when he said it.
I'd been working with monsters, and I didn't know it. I thought the Nazis were the monsters, and I was so afraid of them. I was wrong.
He was so afraid of the Nazis, said Libor, that he betrayed that little village to them. Oh, he took money, too. But mostly it was to save his own skin. We'd never have known it, but he started dating one of my pack, and he lied to her about it.
Libor's commentary and the ghosts were so close to the same topic that I wondered if the ghost was somehow influencing Libor, even though he couldn't hear what the dead man said.
The village of Lidice wasn't the only thing he'd given to the Nazis, said the alpha werewolf. He sold them some of our group, too. One of the ones he sold was a boy who ran messages for us. He was 10.
No one important, said Danek. Just a few so the Nazis would know that I was cooperating fully, so they wouldn't kill me. But I was afraid of the wrong monsters.
He was a coward, said Libor, and he feared the wrong monsters.
The war was over, Danek said. We won. My side won. Then they killed me. I died anyway. It wasn't fair. They didn't even allow me a funeral. No marker for my grave, no mourners.
He died too easily, Libor said. But the war was over, and time enough had passed that we couldn't just leave his body. So we buried it here.
He nodded toward a corner of the garden.
Under the cobblestones beneath that green table.
I see, I said. The effect of the two-sided narration was really eerie.
Danek is the only ghost here? Asked Libor.
I made a production of looking around carefully. Yes, he is the only one here in the garden with us. Danek reached out and touched the back of the chair that sat at the green table. Frost followed his fingertips, but melted away quickly. It left no moisture behind, so maybe it hadn't been frost at all, but some sort of residue. I'd never seen a ghost do that.
Then I will give you the sanctuary I offered, Libor said briskly.
Thank you, I said, my eyes still on the ghost. And when you are tired of Danek, let me know. I'll come back and see if I can fix this.
Fix what? Libor asked.
I told you, I said. It isn't smart to pay too much attention to the dead. It is especially not smart for me to pay too much attention to the dead. The chair Danek had touched fell over on its side. Libor jumped and stared at it. I don't think, I said, that Danek is going to be the sweet kind of ghost who finds lost things and contents himself shutting doors a little too hard. We can give him a few weeks to see if he fades on his own, but if that doesn't work, I'll see what I can do. Hopefully I'd be home in a couple of weeks. That would mean I would have to fly back. I could fly back with Adam and see Prague properly. As long as we all survived. Hot water and sweet-smelling soap did a lot for my spirits. I was still stuck in Prague without papers or money, but at least I was clean and had a change of clothes I hadn't had to steal. I had a bed and a safe place to sleep. The clothing they had found me was typical of spare werewolf pack clothes, apparently the world over. Running pants and tank top, a little closer fitting than what our pack used, but still stretchy enough to fit a wide variety of body types, male or female. I had a small room at the top of the stairs, a little isolated from the rest of the living space over the bakery. It was still daylight. I was surrounded by strangers, one of whom was pretty unhappy with me, even if he did acknowledge that I had told him over and over that what he wanted was not a good idea. Even so, I think I was asleep before my body hit the mattress. I woke in darkness, and someone was stroking my cheek gently. I rolled away from the touch and buried my head in the blankets. Leave me alone, I said with force. Then I realized that I was alone in the room, and had been while those fingers had been touching my cheek. I hoped sincerely that it was still a residual effect of meeting the golem that left me such a magnet for the ghosts of Prague. I hoped even more fervently that whatever it was that had caused this would go away soon. I also felt guilty. I try not to give orders to the dead unless it's important because they can't refuse me, not if I focus my will strongly enough. I wouldn't have done it except that I had been mostly asleep. But I had ordered the ghost to go away, and it had gone. I think it had been trying to warn me because a few minutes later, my door popped open. I was up on my feet beside the bed with my right hand still trying to close around a gun that wasn't there before I was aware enough to remember where I was.
Wake up, woman, said a gruff voice that belonged to a man I hadn't seen before.
He was slender and compact, like a gymnast. If you saw him in a suit, you would never know how much muscle he carried. In the tight tank shirt and jeans, he emphasized it. He looked a little like the man who had followed me until I'd taken refuge in the garden of the friendly mastiff. Maybe they were related. He was one of those men who would look like a teenager until his hair started graying, but since he was a werewolf, that would never happen.
I wondered if he'd learned to turn that into a strength yet. I'd been raised in the Morocco's pack. I never judged the strength of a person by their outward appearance. The Morocco didn't look like a man who held the reins of thousands of werewolves who would die for him. He looked like a pizza delivery boy or a gas station attendant, right up until he didn't. "What do you need?" I asked.
"Libor says to tell you that there are vampires here looking for you and being forceful about it. We need to move you. Gather your things and I'll take you."
His voice was British pure, though that wasn't a guarantee that he was from the UK. Most English speakers in Europe, I was discovering, had learned to speak British English rather than the American version. I turned on the table lamp and realized that my other set of clothing was in the wash. I put the borrowed shoes on without socks and took the pack that contained a very little money and a dead e-reader. "Ready," I said. Danek met us at the base of the stairs and pointed in the opposite direction the werewolf was trying to take me. That left me in a quandary. Ghosts, like the Fae, don't lie. They are so literal, you have to be careful about believing anything they say. He might have been pointing us toward the bad guys instead of away. Before I could ask him anything, Libor's dead wife appeared and pointed the same way. "Tell him to take the way through the kitchens," she said. "The vampires have the usual exit surrounded." "The ghosts say that there are vampires at the usual exits," I told the werewolf. "We need to use the way through the kitchens." He froze. "I only get weirder the longer you know me," I told him, quoting one of the t-shirts I'd gotten for my last birthday. His nostrils flared, and he looked around a little wildly trying to see the ghosts, I think. Danek brushed against a table, making it scrape across the floor, and the werewolf jumped. I rolled my eyes, a gesture I'd caught from my teenage stepdaughter. Sometimes it was the only thing that properly expressed my opinion. Seriously? The werewolf was afraid of ghosts? Ignoring him, I started down the route Libor's dead wife was still indicating, across the room and down a dark hallway.
"I thought ghosts were just bits and pieces of the person who died," said the werewolf very quietly as he passed me.
He seemed to suddenly know where we were going and led the way at a brisk pace. "Yes," I said. "No, sometimes." His words were close enough to what I'd said to Libor that I was pretty sure Libor had been talking to his wolves. And well he should, because though his wife had been relatively benign, I was pretty sure Danek was going to be a problem.
"Then why are they warning us about something happening right now?" he asked.
The hall floor suddenly dropped about 3 inches and took a jag to the right. A few paces farther on, there were 3 shallow stairs that took us up about 1 foot altogether. The wolf had continued speaking quietly as he held my arm to make sure I didn't stumble up the steps.
"If they are just bits and pieces, don't you think they should be moaning here and tossing things about rather than giving warnings about vampires?"
"Some of them retain a lot of their predecessor's personality," I told him. "Though I've wondered about the nature of ghosts for exactly the same kinds of reasons. All well and good to dismiss them as nothings when one of them wasn't leaving you drawings or another one wasn't trying to help you survive, but I gave him the only answer I had. The ones who bear grudges or are extremely attached to someone who is still living seem to be the most independent of thought." The kitchens were huge, and there were 2 of them. The front half was modern and filled with ovens, various kinds of cooking surfaces, and giant mixing machines taller than I was, with bowls that sat on the ground. Everything was immaculate. There was a half wall and a wider than the usual doorway opening that led into a room that looked as though it had been pulled directly from the Middle Ages. The far wall had a giant fireplace with a spit. Beside it was a stack of metal pots that looked as though they should have a witch throwing eyes of newts and snail tails or something in them. One of the long walls was covered by a giant brick oven with rows and columns of regularly spaced openings that were about 2 feet square. My werewolf guide trotted right up to the farthest opening and climbed through. I did the same and found that the inside of the oven was a room in its own right. Against one of the inner walls was a narrow metal ladder, up which my guide was already climbing. I followed him up a couple of stories and out to the roof of the building. The werewolf had quit talking and was making an effort to be silent, so I followed suit.
We weaved our way between chimneys on the roof of the bakery. When we reached the end of the bakery, there was a narrow hop, and we kept going on the roof of the next building. We probably made a quarter of a mile before we jumped to the ground. The werewolf, still quiet, didn't speed up from the easy jog we'd begun on the rooftops, and he took us into a more residential and modern section of the town. In total, we ran maybe 6 miles, long enough for me to regret my lack of socks. He took me to a garage under an apartment building built in the last 100 years and stopped by a motorcycle. He started to get on it, then stopped.
"We'll attract too much attention without helmets," he said. "Wait here, I'll be right back."
He was as good as his word, returning with a pair of helmets. He tossed me one and put on the other himself. Mine wasn't a perfect fit, and I didn't like the way it restricted my vision, but I didn't complain. When he mounted the bike, I climbed on behind him and held on. The last time I'd ridden behind someone on a motorcycle, I'd been in college. Char, my roommate, had had a Harley. We'd taken it out and gone camping now and then, just to get away from school. This bike was about half the size of Char's, and much quieter, but being a passenger behind the werewolf wasn't much different than being a passenger behind Char had been.
7. Adam.
Buonarroti's villa in Milan in the wee small hours of the first night I spent in Prague. At this moment, I was huddled next to the Vltava while a ghost dripped water on my head. So this chapter begins before the previous chapter started. I told you it was going to get tricksy.
They were given a large suite with 3 bedrooms, each equipped with a king-sized bed and a bathroom. They looked pristine and newly remodeled, but this was a very old building, and it had seen a lot of violence. Adam could smell the faint musk of fear and the rotten iron of old blood, as if it, like the stone, wood, and paint, was part of the material that made up the structure. Their luggage had been piled tidily inside the main door of the suite when they got there. Adam figured that they'd been driven from the airfield the long way to allow the luggage to beat them. "Dress for dinner, he says," said Larry as soon as their escorting vampire guide had left. "It's 4 in the morning Milan time."
"You can hardly expect vampires to eat in the day," said Marsilia.
"Or to eat at all," offered Honey. "Are we going to be dinner?"
"They always have last meal at 5 a.m. here," answered Stefan. "Dinner is a word used for guests. Think of it as a very early breakfast, if you'd like. There are usually guests who aren't vampires. Buonarroti uses it as a gathering for the seed. There will be fresh blood for all the vampires, and good food for everyone else."
Elisaveta had paced around the room, muttering to herself. She entered the first bedroom, and Larry moved to follow her.
"Leave her be," said Stefan. "She's checking for magic. Buonarroti has a few witches in his employ. Had a very good witch at one time, and according to rumor, a fey half-blood. There are a lot of things a witch could do to us without breaking guesting laws. I don't have to tell you to clean your hairbrushes and burn the stray hairs, do I?"
"Standard stuff," grumbled Larry amiably. "Trimmed toenails get eaten, I know."
Honey made a sound, and the goblin flashed a grin at her.
"Of course you can flush them if you'd like. I prefer to be certain. Witches are bitches, and they'll burn your britches, sure as kittens have itches, if you give them half a chance."
Elisaveta was in one of the bedrooms. She might not have heard Larry, but Honey was standing right next to him.
"I'm a bitch," said Honey in a smooth voice.
The goblin laughed. "That you are, dearie. Don't take offense where none is meant."
He wasn't dumb, thought Adam. This was about establishing boundaries. He was telling the room that he was sure enough of his ability to protect himself that he wasn't afraid of offending anyone in the room.
Good to know.
Adam was sure he'd appreciate the information at some other time. Just as he was sure that another time he'd have been pleased and impressed with the suite they'd been given.
"Just keeping things out in the open," said Honey.
But she wasn't really paying attention to the goblin. She was watching Adam out of the corner of her eye. The noise of their getting-to-know-you bickering rubbed like sandpaper on Adam's skin. Adam was sure before this was over he'd be wishing for a hotel room by himself, or with Mercy. He checked, like a man with a toothache, and their bond was still there. He wasn't getting much from it. He knew it was because she was no longer here, and that without more of the pack, he couldn't reach her more clearly. His control was fraying. His wolf... No, to be honest, it wasn't just his wolf who wanted to rip out Buonarrota's throat. Having his pack back home was not making his wolf any more comfortable, any safer for the people around him. Honey knew it. She wasn't exactly avoiding him, but she was being very careful not to meet his eyes and to give him plenty of space. If he let this continue, he'd either kill Buonarrota or Buonarrota would kill him. And that's what they had come here to prevent, right? Part of him, the biggest part of him, and not just the monster, wondered why he was standing in the vampire's stronghold and not over the vampire's dead body or out hunting down Mercy. He abruptly turned to Marsilia, interrupting a quiet-voiced conversation she was having with Stefan about sleeping arrangements. "Tell me that leaving Buonarrota animate another hour is the right thing to do," he said, "and make me believe it." If he couldn't figure it out, maybe someone else could. If not, Adam didn't know what was in his face, but Marsilia looked at him and stilled. But it was Stefan who answered him. "Jacopo Buonarrota is a monster," Stefan said. "He does terrible things, then lies to himself about it because he doesn't want to believe that he is any different from the Renaissance prince he once was." "I agree," Marsilia said a little sadly. "He was never a hero like you were, Stefan, no matter what either of us tried to believe." Stefan didn't look at her, just continued to speak. "Jacopo Buonarrota is an addict who glories in his addiction because it brings him more power. He broke the werewolf he feeds upon so that no one will ever believe that the addiction he won't admit to is a weakness or a problem to anyone except the poor damned wolf." Everyone, including Elisaveta, had stopped doing whatever they'd been doing to pay attention to Stefan. "He is a monster," said Stefan. "But he is good at it, good at survival, and that makes him good for the rest of the monsters who have to live, seen or unseen, with the human population, who have grown a lot more deadly since they virtually wiped out the witch population in Europe. It was a civil war among the witch families that did the most damage," said Elisaveta. "But the Inquisition was thorough about sniffing out the remainders." Stefan nodded carefully in Elisaveta's direction, giving her the point. Then he continued, "Buonarrota is smart, savvy, and incredibly wealthy, and he uses it to ensure his own survival. But because he sees his survival as depending upon how the supernatural predators interact with humans, he is a very strong force for stability." Marsilia put her hand out and touched Stefan, who fell silent. "Killing him," Marsilia said, "will cause the death of thousands, not just the vampires, but all of the people who will fall victim to their power plays." She hesitated briefly. "Mercy doesn't need you, Adam. She doesn't need us to rescue her or avenge her. She rescued herself. By doing so, she gave us the opportunity to build bridges, to keep all the monsters," here she curtsied with an ironic lift of her brow, "behaving themselves." It was a good answer. Adam didn't know that it would be enough of a good answer to keep him from going for Buonarrota's throat at the first opportunity. Mercy's rescuing herself didn't mean that Buonarrota deserved to be excused for taking her in the first place. He remembered the blood and glass all over the SUV. All of Mercy's blood staining the leather seat, the necklace he kept tucked safely in his pocket. "He nearly killed my wife," Adam said. Stefan said, "But he failed." "Not good enough," Adam said. "Not a good enough reason." There was a small silence. Then Larry spoke. "You aren't used to dealing with bad guys who are this much more powerful than you are," he said. "No offense meant. One-on-one, if you and Buonarrota got into it, and the betting would be pretty even. But Buonarrota isn't just an old vampire. He's the head of a collective of vampires, just as your Maroc is the head of a collective of werewolves. And it is the collective that is most important to the choice you are making tonight." Adam looked at the goblin, and Larry dropped his eyes without otherwise changing his body language. Larry wasn't afraid of him. He was just doing his best not to cause a fight. "Go on," he said.